Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-5396, Camden County Council on Economic Opportunity Appellant versus United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. Mr. Graham for the appellant, Ms. Merriweather for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Robert Graham for the appellant, Camden County Council on Economic Opportunity. For the sake of brevity, I'll refer to my client as counsel throughout. There are essentially four issues in this appeal, three of which are related, the others somewhat discreet. The first three issues that we've raised concern the agency's statutory authority, or the agency's regulatory authority, more appropriately, to impose unilaterally a 90-day corrective action period for deficiencies identified as part of a review of their Head Start grant. The first question is whether the agency's own binding regulations allowed for a 90-day corrective action period, and the answer to that is no.
Isn't the first question how you were injured by that?
I think in every case that's going to be the first issue, and the fact of the matter is that yes, we were in fact injured by the unilateral imposition of the 90-day corrective action period.
How do you know?
Because we know that had we had more time, we would have had a better opportunity.
Why do you assume you would have had more time if the agency had not had a 90-day option?
Because under the statute, when you follow the quality improvement plan process, it's actually something of a give and take between the agency and the awardee.
How do you know that would have been the agency's choice?
I can't say for certain that it would have been the agency's choice, but in my experience with the Head Start program, I've certainly never seen a quality improvement plan process that lasted anything less than 6 months.
You're assuming the agency would have gone to the quality improvement plan option. Under the word immediately, might it not have chosen all kinds of things, including possibly 90 days, but we'll put that aside. But for example, 60 days.
I'm not sure that I understand your question. If I understand you correctly.
Is there any reason that we can, putting ourselves in the shoes of the agency at that moment, the moment of picking 90 days, do we have any basis for supposing that they would have, had they accepted your argument, chosen a longer or negotiated a longer period with your client? I mean, is there a track record of this type of corrective action being given by a QIP, effectively more time?
Well, yes, and I think that gets back to my earlier comment that I and my firm, we've got a fairly substantial practice with Head Start awardees. Never seen a quality improvement plan that didn't allow for correction in anything less than 6 months.
You're assuming that we're in a quality improvement plan land, and I'm asking how we justify that assumption.
Well, assuming that the agency has the three choices that they say they have.
Assuming that it has the two choices that you say it has, immediately, which appears to have covered quite a range of periods, and QIP, why might it not have chosen immediately in the sense of, say, 30 days, which seems to be a clear option, or 60 days?
Well, because the agency...
Or 89 days.
Because the agency has limited itself in that respect.
Yes, I understand that.
But you
keep essentially arguing that it has to have accepted the quality improvement plan option, and I haven't seen anything in the briefs that supports that.
Well, I think maybe we're talking across purposes here. When I say
jump in here, is this the kind of thing, or were these the kinds of deficiencies that the agency had authority to require correction immediately
for? No, and thank you. Yes, they are not. The agency has limited itself to imposing the immediate corrective action to circumstances where there is a threat to the integrity of federal funds or a threat to the health and safety of staff or program participants.
Well, the rusty nails in the boards were a threat to, or maybe they were on the 30 days.
They were on the 30 days, that's correct.
Also, in this case, did not the agency draw a distinction between what it thought had to be corrected immediately and then what did not?
Yes, there were 12 total deficiencies identified as a result of the initial review. Four of them required immediate correction. Those four, say with the caveat that gets to our notice issue, those four were corrected immediately. In fact, of the 12 deficiencies identified, eight were corrected within the period that was allotted by the agency. There were four remaining deficiencies that the agency identified as a result of the follow-up review.
I do want to get back to the basic legal issue, but in terms of the 90 days, going back to Judge Williams' initial question, your clients never indicated that they couldn't achieve the correction within 90 days, did they? I mean, they never objected that it was impracticable.
Well, my client, in fact, submitted a quality improvement plan. After they received the notice of the deficiencies, they submitted a quality improvement plan. The agency did not act on that. Presumably, they were acting on the belief that this was going to follow the typical process of the give and take between the agency and the awardee, but that's not what happened in this circumstance. They didn't raise the legal arguments that we raised in this appeal initially, in large part because they wanted to focus their attentions on correcting the deficiencies that were identified.
So your argument here is that where a statute provides for two options and the agency promulgates a regulation that says we have two options, and then Congress comes along later, amends the statute and says now you have three options, that the agency's regulation limits its authority to act under the amendment?
Yes. I mean,
how can that be?
Because the statute is not inconsistent with a regulation and vice versa.
But haven't we, in various opinions, indicated that if a regulation is merely parroting the language of the statute, which is what I think happened here, that if a statute is subsequently amended, there's no indication in that regulation that the agency intended to limit its discretion? I mean, it's not as though the regulation said we have two options no matter what Congress may say in the future.
No, that's true, but it did say that we have two options. And the relevant inquiry is whether the agency intended by issuing this regulation to create a binding norm.
Create a binding norm which would bind it even when Congress changed the underlying statute. That's the real question.
Well, I don't think...
There are two periods, right? There's the period when the regulation tracks the statute, right? Mm-hmm. And the binding effect of the regulation is a completely metaphysical question in that period. Isn't that true? It has no consequence at all.
The regulation?
Right.
Yeah. Well, the regulation does have some consequence because, well, A, the agency itself understood that the statute required them to issue implementing regulations.
How is that different from the agency just following the statute, which it was required to do?
It's different to the extent that you've got essentially you've got permissive language in the statute that was added.
Particular things, right?
And to that extent, regardless of whether the language in the regulation entirely tracks the language of the statute or whether it differs in some material respect, the fact that they have not amended their regulation to avail themselves of this additional authority afforded by the amendment to the statute, it still has a limiting effect.
The statute. Go ahead.
That's the question, right? And it seems to me to answer that question, the preliminary question is what Judge Rogers said. What would the intent of the agency have been with respect to this future period when Congress gave it broader choices?
Well, I don't think that anybody would be able to say that the agency intended to bind itself in perpetuity regardless of any changes in the statute. However, they did intend to create a binding norm.
A binding norm during the period when it was indistinguishable from the statutory norm.
I don't believe that's a fair limitation to place on that. They intended to create a binding norm.
Where do you see in anything the agency did an intent to bind itself in a period when a future period, when it was given broader options by Congress?
There is nothing to point to in the regulatory history or in the regulation itself that would reveal that intent, but at the same time, we don't need to show that intent. What we need to show is an intent to create a binding norm, and by definition, by issuing
I thought you were relying somewhat on the difference between a mandatory statute and a permissive statute. Is your theory that the new statute permits three options, but it, in the discretion of the secretary, I think is the language, but it doesn't mandate the three options, and therefore it doesn't, on its own force, override the regs?
Well, yes, we do rely on that distinction in part. The agency at various points in the litigation argued that the amendments, the 1998 amendments to the Head Start Act superseded 45 CFR 130460. But because the amendments to the statute in 1998 were permissive in nature and not mandatory, there was no inherent inconsistency between the statute and the regulation.
And the amendment was self-executing. I mean, it didn't say, and the secretary must promulgate regulations,
well,
indicating
actually,
the factors the secretary will take into account in exercising her discretion.
That's not the approach that the agency took. Certainly, prior to this litigation.
Congress didn't limit the secretary. It just said the secretary shall have discretion.
The secretary, if in the secretary's discretion, he or she determines that the 90 days is reasonable in light of the magnitude and nature of the deficiencies. But that's really no different from the other portions of the statute dealing with termination and corrective action. And prior to the amendments, the agency understood the statute to require implementing regulations. And when you look at the preamble to both the proposed rule and the final rule for 45 CFR 130460 at the time in 1996, the express purpose in adopting the regulations or proposing the rule was because the statute required it.
Well, for 10 years, the agency apparently hasn't thought the statute did require it. I mean, you say for 10 years they haven't promulgated a regulation.
They haven't promulgated a regulation amending what's on the books. So whether that's by design or by lethargy or by inattention or what have you, the fact of the matter is the regulation is as it stands.
Can I ask you one question, which is, what if we agree with you on one of your arguments but not the other? What happens here? Suppose we agree with you on the 90-day but not the 30-day, or vice versa. What happens?
Well, then the decision of the district court stands, because the Head Start Act allows for termination based on a single deficiency.
Okay. Just wanted to confirm that.
I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Counsel for Appley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robin Merriweather for Appley's HHS and Kathleen Sebelius. The board's interpretation of its regulations and the statute was not arbitrary and capricious and should be affirmed. As the board held in this case and in prior cases, HHS had the authority to set a 90-day corrective period, and that authority flows from the statute.
Why hasn't the agency changed the regulation in the 10 years since it obtained that statutory authority?
That's not in the record, Your Honor. However, the statute does not require that regulations be set to implement that authority.
The statute does refer to the 90-day period being invoked in the discretion of the secretary, and usually in administrative law cases, regulations set forth how the secretary will exercise his or her discretion under a statute. And here, one would naturally then turn to the regulations, which haven't been changed, and find that there are only two options, the immediate option or the QIP option.
There are two answers to that question, Your Honor. First, the statute actually says that the secretary shall, with respect to each identified deficiency, require the agency to take one of three courses. And so I'm not sure that it is as permissive as Your Honor suggests, because it does say that the agency shall take one of these three steps. And the second response is that in terms of looking to the regulations to see what the agency intends, the regulations, there are no regulations that postdate the statute. And if you look at the regulations and you look at when they were passed, it should be clear to a grantee reading the regulations, that the regulations are not saying anything about this third option.
I really question that. Should be clear to the grantee. The PRISM guide doesn't even refer to the 90-day period. Isn't that correct?
The PRISM guide does not, but the PRISM guide says that.
So if you're a grantee and you're navigating the PRISM guide, no reference to 90-day period, let's look at the regulations. Reference to 90-day period. You're saying, essentially, the government's argument, as I understand it, is the regulation is so obviously inconsistent with the statute that people should, of course, know to ignore the regulation and follow the statute. Well,
that's not exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. Actually, the grantee could look to Departmental Appeals Board precedent. The Departmental Appeals Board, in at least two cases prior to the incident case, has recognized that the 90-day corrective period is an option. The board's ruling that's appealed here cites to one of those decisions, and that's on page 37 of the joint appendix. Also, the Norwalk Economic Opportunity Now case, which was cited in the district court record, is a November 2005 Departmental Appeals Board decision, and in that decision, when the board notes what the corrective options are that are available to the agency, it lists the 90-day requirement.
But those decisions, of course, have been incorporated into the PRISM guide. I guess you can navigate those. That's a good answer. That's one option, I suppose.
And those decisions are published on the HHS website. The Departmental Appeals Board issues its decisions, and then Norwalk Opportunity Now was issued in November 2005, so that would postdate the PRISM guide.
What kind of gets me in the big picture of this case is these violations, some of them were incredibly hyper-technical. Leaves on the playground, that's the reason for revoking a Head Start grant. And yet HHS, you know, the same standard of precisions applied to your regulations didn't exactly jump through the hoops that it has set out for itself.
Your Honor, actually, I would disagree with your characterization of the violations as hyper-technical. There was more than leaves on the playground. We had piles of debris. We had a gas grill. We had rusty nails. There were quite a few things beyond leaves on the playground.
You don't defend that example, do you?
I don't defend what example?
Grant because of leaves, right?
Leaves were.
If you were here on that deficiency alone, you'd be very embarrassed, right?
If leaves were the only problem, Your Honor,
it seems
unlikely.
Like to play at leaves.
But yeah, if there were only leaves, that we probably wouldn't be here. But there were significantly more than leaves, and that was a 30-day deficiency.
Right. To follow up on that. One of Judge Rogers' questions on the difficulty of complying within 90 days. My understanding for the medical, vision, and hearing screenings is that the grantee, Camden, was really at the mercy of the parents obtaining the records from the relevant doctors and getting the records turned into the school, which even in the best of circumstances is going to be a difficult process to get 100% compliance within 90 days. Is that and they got something like 52 out of 57 or something like that. Is that accurate?
No, Your Honor. My understanding is that the board and HHS have the discretion to determine when 90 days is appropriate, and this court has to defer to that. But also, my understanding of the records deficiencies.
All I was trying to say is there is a reason here why 90 days may have been difficult, because it wasn't just up to the grantee to say, okay, we have to have vision screenings in the next 90 days at the school. And what they needed was each set of parents, and sometimes there aren't parents, and to get the relevant records for the children back to them within 90 days. The point being that can make the 90-day period somewhat difficult to comply with.
That's what CCC argued. However, the board found that there was no factual dispute that CCC failed to satisfy that 90-day period, and Congress has given HHS the discretion to decide what corrective period is appropriate. So whether or not it would be difficult for the grantee to satisfy the standards, that doesn't change the fact that the agency had the discretion to set that 90-day period in the first instance.
When you refer to the statute being self-executing, and therefore the regulation didn't need to be changed, I have some question about the regulation, because the regulation could have been written in such a way as to say, if there's a deficiency, the agency can require compliance within an option specified by statute. And then when the statute's updated, necessarily, if there were a cross-reference in the regulation of the statute, when the statute's updated, bang, the regulation's also updated. But that's not what this regulation said. It wasn't specifically tied to the statute.
The regulation parroted the language of the statute. It's true that the regulation did not simply say.
There are regulations, certainly, that are out there that specifically tie themselves to statutory language, and when the statutory language is updated, by definition, the regulation is updated. That's not the kind of regulation we have here.
That's true, Your Honor, but again, agencies have the discretion, and courts should defer to their choices in terms of how to draft the regulations. And in this circumstance, there was no statutory requirement that the agency amend its regulations, or that the agency even have passed these regulations in the first place. The agency could have set 90-day periods, or could have set...
I really have a problem with the agency could have done X, could have done Y kind of arguments, because, and your argument about agency intent here, the best evidence of the agency's intent is what it actually adopted through notice and comment regulation.
Yes, Your Honor,
And the best evidence of the agency's intent since 1998 is the failure to update that regulation.
With that, I disagree. The agency's intent, looking at the notice and comment and the regulation, reflects what the agency intended to do in 1996. There's no question that in 1996 the agency could not have intended to restrict itself from exercising power that it did not have at that time. What we infer from the fact that the agency didn't change its regulations afterward becomes a question of what else has the agency said. And here in the board's rulings, the agency has said, not only in this case but in prior cases, that it can impose a 90-day corrective period.
Is there any kind of internal agency document that says, that you're aware of, that says we don't need to update this regulation because statutory language is obviously self-executing?
That's not in the record, and we were never asked for that, so I'm not aware whether that exists. But the Departmental Appeals Board is a component of HHS, which expresses the agency's interpretation of its regulations and the programs that it implements. And the Departmental Appeals Board has said that it can impose a 90-day requirement, not just in this case, but in at least two prior cases. The CCC also argues that it lacked notice of the fact that it had to correct the unsafe and unclean conditions at all of its facilities instead of the two specific playgrounds that were referenced in the deficiency notice. And again, board precedent, as well as the regulations and the deficiency notice, gave CCC notice that it had to bring all of its program into compliance.
Why didn't it say that?
Actually, the letter did say that we are inspecting your program and you have to correct the deficiencies at your program, in the program. There's nothing in the letter that says that CCC only has to correct the specific examples.
No, but the statute and the fair reading of the notice is you have deficiencies at, I think it's Charleston and Hayes, and you need to correct those. And then you correct those, and lo and behold, you're told, but you're still going to lose your grant because there's a deficiency at a whole different location, Lois 1.
That's actually not in the statute at all. The statute refers to deficiencies, and the question is, how do we define a deficiency? A deficiency has been defined as an area of performance, and in the first state case, which is a 2003 Departmental Appeals Board decision, the board actually addressed this issue and explained that there's a difference between correcting a deficiency and correcting a specific manifestation of that deficiency. And in that case, the board held, as it held in this case, that simply correcting one manifestation that's referenced in the deficiency notice does not actually correct.
I'm just saying, as a grantee, I'd be very frustrated by the agency's inability to articulate that in the notice. It would be nice if the agency actually told people that before they pulled their Head Start funding.
But the agency did tell CCC
that. Not in that notice.
The notice said you have to correct the deficiency. The notice said nothing about specific locations having to be corrected. And the notice said that you had to correct the program.
But I thought the deficiencies identified in this aspect of the notice were deficiencies at Charleston and Hayes.
Those were what were listed as examples of what the deficiency was, but the
did it use the word examples?
No, it said you have to correct the deficiency in your program, and it also cited to the regulations and said that they had to correct the violation of the regulation, which requires safety and clean conditions. And the regulations expressly provide that that a Head Start grantee has to ensure that each facility is maintained in a way that satisfies the safety and hazard conditions, and that each facility has to be inspected. So it's clear from the regulations, from the board's prior interpretation of what it means to correct a deficiency, and the references to the program itself, that simply picking and choosing and fixing one specific manifestation of a deficiency does not cure the overall problem. CCC had an obligation to ensure that each facility was maintained in a certain way and could not reasonably have expected that when HHS came to inspect the facilities for the second visit, that it would ignore clear evidence that any facilities had not been.
The agency could have, when it discovered the problem at Lois 1, issued a new notice of deficiency at Lois 1, thereby triggering a new 30-day period for that, correct? Could have done that.
It could have, yes, but it didn't have to. If Your Honor.
Where has the agency said that the program and the regulatory scheme is based on an assumption that the agency is not going to be able to inspect at every facility and every site, and that's why the regulations speak in terms of the program, regardless of how many sites the program exists? Is that in a board decision?
That is, the board decision discusses the fact that inspections generally involve a representative sample of the sites and the specific issues, and
that's First State or Newark?
I believe that is
I can check.
First State, but I'm not certain, Your Honor.
One of the two.
If Your Honors have no further questions, we'll rest on our briefs. We ask that you affirm the board's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, affirm the district court's decision. All right. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you. I'd like to at least touch briefly on the issue of the adequacy of the notice of the need to address the conditions at the Lois 1 site. As to the comments about sampling and that the statute and the regulations contemplate doing inspecting representative samples. As part of the initial review, Lois 1 was, in fact, inspected. and it was not, and there was no reference to Lois 1 or the conditions in the exterior of Lois 1 in the initial review report. So certainly based on what the reviewers had done in the initial review, the council certainly would not have been on notice of any deficiency or deficient conditions at the Lois 1 site.
Well, you agree that the regulation talks about safety for staff and clients.
Yes.
And that rusty nails can't be on a playground surface where children are playing.
Correct.
All right. So they inspect three sites, and they point out in their report, you've got rusty nails at this site, number one. You've got rusty nails at site number two. I don't understand why they have to say more than you have rusty nails at one site. And then it's your obligation to be sure under the regulations that all the other sites are safe. Well, I mean, I think the point of the leaves on the playground is to suggest, you know, that there is a limit to this notion. But certainly with rusty nails in a playground area where children are going to play.
Well, certainly in all instances, an awardee is required to meet the performance standards, 100%. But when you're when you look at the remedial process that the statute and the regulations contemplate, an awardee with deficiencies needs to be on notice of what they need to do in order to correct those deficiencies. Otherwise, that whole scheme is somewhat meaningless or becomes something of a crapshoot.
Isn't what the board is saying is that, look, you're establishing this program with federal money, subject to federal regulations. It's your responsibility. We may do some audits every now and then to be sure you're complying with the regulations, but it's your responsibility. It's not our responsibility to go check each site to be sure there are no nails on the playground.
It's not the agency's responsibility to check each site to make sure that there are no nails on the playground. However, in this circumstance, they took a look at the conditions at Lois 1 to begin with, and they found nothing wrong with the conditions at Lois 1. I would like to just point out very, very briefly that when you look at the follow-up review report and the description of what happened and what the conditions were like at Lois 1, it appears that the one remaining deficient condition on the second day of the inspection was a hole in the ground. Well, the hole in the ground was the result of the council staff removing a tent pole that the reviewers directed them to remove. So essentially you have a metal pole that was in cement in the ground. The reviewers directed staff to remove it. They removed it. They came back the following day and said, oh, now you've got a hole in the ground. That's a hazard. That appears to be. Apparently, it was about 10 inches across and about a foot deep.
Can I ask you a question? What is the current status of Camden's funding? Because it continued to get it during the administrative appeal, and then it was cut off. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, can it reapply?
Well, it could reapply for funding. At this point, there is
a new grant, like any other new grantee
right.
application.
Right. The odds of being selected, I think, are fairly slim to, well, none.
Because there's a penalty based on past performance or
correct.
Just the realities of how this works?
Correct. And I would hasten to point out that as a result of the termination of their Head Start grant, they have also lost funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the CACFP, Child and Adult something food program.
How much funding was at stake?
The funding for the CACFP program or Head Start?
Head Start.
Head Start, I don't have it off the top of my head, but there were 1,300 children as of 2007 in the program. So it was toward the large end of the scale in terms of Head Start programs. I'm going to look at my client very briefly and say $4.5 million. $13 million.
Okay, $13 million, 1,300 children. Is this a year-round program?
Yeah, it was a full 12-month program. It was only regular Head Start, not early Head Start.
So what happens to those children now?
Those children, well, the services have been curtailed fairly substantially. The size of the program has dropped drastically now that there is an interim grantee in place.
And do those children go to other Head Start programs, or they're just not going to any program at all?
Where the Head Start program has shrunk, they are either not going anywhere or they're going to some other early childhood education program, perhaps funded by the state or by the local school district. The interim grantee is under contract with HHS. They are in the facilities that were previously occupied by the council, and some of which are titled to the council, some of which they're under lease with the council, and the council has negotiated something with the landlord that allows the interim grantee to be operating out of that space.
When you say interim grantee, sorry to ask all these factual questions, but does that mean the same programs are basically ongoing but with different management?
Same program with different management, but smaller scale at this point, and certainly it's not with the same community leadership. The Camden County Council on Economic Opportunity was a community action program, and has the board structure, the tripartite board structure that's contemplated under the community services or the community action statutes. So you've got representatives from the community, representatives from local government, and then representatives from the folks that receive the services. You no longer have that, at least with the interim grantee and the Head Start program.
Just one last question. I hope it's one. You aren't arguing that your client took any steps in reliance on the regulation, the tracking regulation, different from what it would have taken had it known that read the various board rulings and therefore been aware that that HHS regarded the statute as controlling regardless of the regulation. Is that correct?
If I understand you correctly, would they have done anything different had they believed that or had they understood that they had to go through the quality improvement plan process rather than listening to the agency and correcting within 90 days?
No. Would they have done anything different at any time when it made any difference had they known earlier that HHS took the view that it had all the options under the statute?
I don't know. I don't.
You don't. That's not part of your case.
No, that's not part of our case.
That was the relevance of the question, whether or not your client had objected that it was impracticable for it to achieve these corrections within this 90-day period.
No, I understand. As I indicated before, the council submitted a quality improvement plan along with a description of what they understood the deficiencies to be, what they understood needed to be correct, and what they proposed to do in the time frame within which they were going to correct those deficiencies. But the quality improvement plan was sort of dead in the water.
But did that plan indicate more than 90 days was required? You say most of these plans were 6 months or more.
Correct. I don't recall. I don't recall seeing anything that would have provided more than 90 days. I think that what they were concerned with at the time was trying to act as quickly as possible in order to try to avoid any dispute with the agency and to ensure that they can maintain their funding.
Right. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.